From the Free Speech Project at Georgetown University, this is Speaking Freely. I'm Sanford Unger, and on this episode of Speaking Freely, we talk with David Sanger of the New York Times about tension between national security and the First Amendment. The two came into conflict in June 1971, when the New York Times began publishing what came to be known as the Pentagon Papers, a secret history of U.S. involvement in Vietnam. The Washington Post was forced to play catch-up, even as a court ordered the Times to suspend their series. The Post obtained the papers and had to decide whether to publish them. These events are recounted in the movie The Post, starring Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks.
So, can I ask you a hypothetical question?
Oh, dear, I don't like hypothetical questions.
Well, I don't think you're going to like the real one either.
Do you have the papers?
Not yet. The Times has 7,000 pages detailing how the White House has been lying about the Vietnam War for 30 years. Let's do our jobs. Find those pages.
The New York Times was barred from publishing any more classified documents dealing with the Vietnam War.
We could all go to prison.
If the government wins, the Washington Post will cease to exist.
If we don't hold them accountable,
who will?
We can't hold them accountable if we don't have a newspaper.
Nixon will muster the full power of the presidency, and if there's a way to destroy you, by God, he'll find it.
I'm asking your advice, Bob, not your permission.
What are you going to do, Mrs. Graham?
Those are promotional clips from the movie The Post, starring Meryl Streep as then-Washington Post publisher Katharine Graham and Tom Hanks as Ben Bradley, then the paper's executive editor. Ultimately, the Supreme Court ruled on June 30, 1971, that the government could not bar the Times and the Post from publishing the papers, since doing so would not threaten national security. It's not unusual for our guest, David Sanger, to find himself at the intersection of national security and First Amendment rights. He's the longtime national security correspondent for the New York Times. I began our conversation asking Sanger about covering national security since Donald Trump was sworn in as president.
We have not yet had any significant conflict with the Trump administration on national security issues. The moment will come. But I think maybe the place to frame this, Sandy, is why is this such a particularly hard problem? Everybody is in agreement that all aspects of American policy, what's done in the names of the people of the United States, have to be fully covered by all media. When you hit foreign policy issues, most of that's out into the open. You can see the public policy making. Then there's a layer behind that of sort of secret diplomacy and so forth. The hard questions come when you are dealing with either covert operations, military operations, or new technologies that the U.S. government is trying to go cope with, and would make the argument that we are helping our adversary by publishing details of those operations. And then the question comes up, well, why do you publish this? The answer to this is simple. There is a higher form of patriotism out here, which is we have a long record going back many, many decades of the United States doing things under the cover of classification that the U.S. government has later come to regret. And we've regretted many times undercovering some of these issues.
Classic case is the Bay of Pigs.
Bay of Pigs would be a great one, where President Kennedy called Scotty Reston, then the bureau chief of the New York Times, after we had withheld some details of this and said, I wish you had published that story, because you would have kept me from the biggest mistake of my life. But to give you another one, imagine a scenario in which we had had access to the intelligence reports that cast significant doubt that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and had published those prior to the invasion of Iraq. A, would have called into question a public reason that the Bush administration was giving us. B, might have saved the United States from what I think in the, you know, retrospect of 14 years of history, we now consider to be one of the greater strategic errors the United States
Not to mention saving a lot of lives on all sides.
And saving a lot of lives along the way. American, Iraqi, and many others.
Some of these leaks are very different these days from the old times. Shadow brokers, what's that about?
Shadow Brokers isn't a journalistic leak. Shadow Brokers came from the inside of what's called the Tailored Access Operations Unit of the NSA. This is the sort of special forces of the NSA. That appears to be an insider. We don't know for sure. Either they were hacked into or an insider grabbed the stuff. And someone...
And has not been caught.
Has not been caught, as far as we know. And someone, maybe the Russians under some theories, maybe disgruntled employees, have created what's essentially a hard-to-trace website that dumps not only the names of the programs, not only the names of the code names, but the code itself, so that countries that were targeted might actually see the weapons, the cyber weapons.
So is there an argument against publishing that information?
You could certainly make an argument against the details of the information, but our readers, ordinary readers in their times, if I published the source code of a cyber weapon, it would look like zero and one gibberish.
Right.
Okay? It's going to mean nothing. It is important frequently to report on what the U.S. is doing and how it's doing it. So if the U.S. is complaining that the Chinese are coming in and stealing our data, while we, meanwhile, are going inside Chinese companies, that's an important thing to know.
Sure.
You don't necessarily need to provide the source code about how we're getting inside the Chinese companies.
There's a nostalgia sometimes to look back at the Pentagon Papers case and think there was the great moment where the New York Times, the Washington Post, and some others stood up to the Nixon administration, were not intimidated during the court cases to back off at all, and prevailed at the Supreme Court in June of 1971. What would happen today, do you think, if today's Daniel Ellsberg were to walk into the newsroom of the New York Times? First of all, he probably wouldn't walk into the newsroom of the New York Times. He'd use your Dropbox or something like that.
When I teach about that, the first thing I do with students is I tell them, go back and read a few pages of the Pentagon Papers,
right.
Okay? And then come back and tell me why the government tried to stop this. Because when you read the Pentagon Papers, it's history. It was a secret history of how the United States escalated, either knowingly or unknowingly, blundered into a bigger and bigger war, series of bad decisions, series of bad
information. Interesting history, important. Fascinating
history, great diplomatic history, but history. There was nothing at the time it was published in 1971 that would have helped the North Vietnamese one bit. If we published the Pentagon Papers equivalent today, the secret history of how we escalated in Iraq, the secret history of what we failed to do in Syria, the secret history of what we did or didn't do as North Korea gained nuclear weapons, I don't think anybody would blink. They certainly wouldn't bother to go to court. I can't imagine they'd go to the Supreme Court. The national security conversation has actually moved to what happens when you're writing about operations that may be underway now or may still give an opportunity for another country to go react. Now, there have been moments where we have sort of geared up wondering if the U.S. government was going to go relitigate the Pentagon Papers case.
And find a new opportunity to change the law, in other
that's
words.
That's right. So I published in 2012 the first accounts of Olympic Games, code name for the American attacks on Iran's nuclear program.
Right.
It was the first cyber attack by the United States on another country that we know about. And then in March of 2017, my colleague Bill Broad and I published about a similar attack that was mounted over 4 years against North Korea's missile program. Now, in neither of those cases did the United States government attempt to go to court and try to stop the Times from publication. We did sit down with them at various moments and say, look, if there are specific details in here...
Right, so you negotiated with the government, in a sense, and said, if there are things you think we should hold back, let us know.
Let us know. Now, we always say in that case, decision's ours, it's not yours.
I understand.
First
Amendment's
clear.
I think a lot
clear.
Of people in the public are not aware
no,
of that.
No, they're not aware of that whole process. And I certainly made sure that I asked the question, what if this is damaging? Now, I would say to them, particularly in the case of Olympic Games, where the United States made Israel made a technological error and the actual computer code got out onto the internet. Well, I said, look, this is already out because somebody screwed up. So you've got to prove to me that the damage I'm doing here is something that's beyond what the Iranians, the Russians, the Chinese already know. They have the code. They had a couple of techniques they asked me to hold back, and I did hold them back, and what happened? Snowden came along and blew those techniques in his revelations.
So you didn't need to...
Well, I had held it back, and it was a year later that Snowden happened, and I'm not sure how many people associated the techniques he was describing with what was used in Iran, but in any case, he revealed the techniques.
Trump and Steve Bannon, while he was still in the White House, said that the media are the opposition.
But the remarkable thing is we have to admit the fact that that argument has worked pretty well. The media polls slightly lower than Congress and lawyers, okay? That's pretty bad.
But there's also the argument that the media have to be the opposition at a moment like this because there doesn't appear to be much political opposition that's working.
I would push back at the phrase opposition. The media's got to maintain its traditional view that it is a skeptical check on whoever the party in power is. And what I worry about is, and I get a lot of email along these lines, is people saying, you know, the New York Times should become part of the resistance. And I say, no, that's not our role. Right. We're here to do what the founders had in mind for us to do.
But if you look back at Vietnam, David, there was no effective opposition in Congress to the Vietnam War. Appropriations were passed with 90 or 95, 98 votes in their favor. There was nobody resisting policy in the opposition party. Under Johnson, the Republicans weren't doing so. Under Nixon, the Democrats were not
doing
so. That's
right. And if you listen to the Johnson tapes, all of which have now been declassified, broadcast, and whatever, I keep thinking, what a great news story that would have been had it been broken at the time.
At the time.
And it might well have changed the course of the Vietnam War. At moments at which Johnson was publicly declaring we're winning and privately admitting we're losing.
Right.
And where did we see that happen again? In the Iraq War. And when I asked President Bush about this at one point, when I was White House correspondent at the time, he said, I could never get out and declare we were losing. It would demoralize the troops who were bravely putting.
Well, of course.
And that's fine. I fully understand it. But it makes the exact argument about why an independent media has to get out and be reporting on the most sensitive national security issues at the time in a completely unfettered way.
So here's the question. In a context of a free speech project like ours, trying to understand the condition of the First Amendment in the United States today, are the media going to be able to sustain this free posture, this ability to do their job without constant interference and without constantly being accused of being the fake news that actually comes from the other side?
Right. We will be constantly being accused of being the fake news because the phrase fake news, which two years ago, if we were sitting here, would have been to describe, you know, RT making stuff up, has become appropriated by the president to describe news stories he does not like.
To describe the traditional mediated form of American journalism where stories are reported, they're processed by editors, people are very careful. That's what's now called fake news by the president.
That's right. And if you go back over just the Russia investigation, an investigation started with last February, the White House saying no one in the campaign or the transition or the young presidency had been in contact with the Russians. And what we now know, thanks to reporting in the New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN and the New Yorker and many other outlets I'm forgetting along the way here, my big concern is that over the long term, there is a real effort by the Justice Department to find ways to crack down on that. And we had one hint of this from Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, who earlier this year said, we may have to go reconsider the issue of whether or not we subpoena reporters for their sources, not just go after the sources themselves. And that is clearly an effort at intimidation on these issues.
And so we have to worry.
We do. Now, we have not seen action by the Trump administration to go do this. We did see it in the Obama administration. And, you know, President Obama's supporters do not like to hear it.
No, it's true.
But they prosecuted more leak cases
than all the other presidents put together.
All the other presidents combined. I would argue, that President Obama created a set of precedents that is or will enable the Trump administration to push that even further.
That's something we have to be on the guard against, right?
That's right.
I mean, how do we do it? How do we make sure that the media continue to be able to function?
So the first thing you do is you don't think to yourself, I'm not going to push the envelope. You think, I'm going to go out there and do the hardest hitting, fair reporting I can go do, and I'm not going to pull back. That's easier if you're sitting in the newsroom of the New York Times or the Post or some other large news organization that's got a big group of lawyers upstairs.
Sure.
And I don't think people understand the degree to which we frequently bring lawyers into big investigative pieces to say, how can we design this piece to make it more and more insulated against government pressure? Let me give you an example. When Bill Broad and I wrote about the American efforts to sabotage the North Korean missiles, we went out of our way to find a lot of unclassified, publicly available, but hard to find documentation of
sure.
this program, much of which we found on the websites of military contractors.
It's out there, right.
It's out there. And of course, we would download it because we knew that 20 minutes after we called the company and asked them about it, it would disappear from their website. And it did. And we wrote a story that went along with it.
Took some screenshots first, right?
Yes, a lot of them. We wrote a story that said a secret program hidden in plain sight and described that. Part of that is to explain that you can do a lot of this with unclassified material.
Yeah.
But part of that is to say to the U.S. government, hey, before you go prosecute this, you might want to go back and look what's
right.
in the public record.
And actually, one of the lessons of all this over time is that the government is very weak at keeping its secrets.
That's right. And
classifies too much so that things are bound to leak out, and then is not very good at keeping the really things it regards as important secret.
And that gets to, it's a separate issue for a separate series for you, but, you know, if I was king for a day, I would get the U.S. government to design a classification system that has a tiny fraction of what is today classified.
Right.
Nobody ever got fired for overclassifying.
That's right.
And lots
That's
of people have gotten fired for not classifying something that later on turned out to be important.
I was for a time a member of something called the Public Interest Declassification Board, and I've been at briefings and talking about this whole issue. And just the fear on the faces of people in key jobs at the idea that they might be, any of these people might be the one who makes a mistake and doesn't classify something that then gets out. That's what motivates them.
Absolutely.
A lot of the time.
I was out giving a talk at one of the service academies a year or so ago and sat down at lunch with a group of young people, all of whom had been given, you know, low to medium level security clearances
right.
and had to go make these decisions each and every day. And every one of them said to me, we just classify everything
sure.
because you're not going to get in trouble for that. And then the first thing that you hear is, oh my goodness, you published classified information.
That's right.
Not should this information have been classified to begin with.
Last quick question for you, David. Are you doing your work any differently now? I know there are all these electronic digital changes in the way journalists do their work, but politically speaking, the political changes in this country, are you doing your work differently than you were, say, 2 years ago?
Technologically, we're doing a few things.
Sure.
So we're communicating with people over encrypted lines more. We keep almost nothing sensitive in the computer system. But your question really goes to how do you go about the day-to-day.
Right.
And what it is you now recognize that the stakes are dramatically higher. And I think something that we've in the media have found gratifying for the past year, we're actually having people come by and doing protests in front of the New York Times building in favor of what we're doing, okay? I've never seen that before in 35
years. Make sure
you get
pictures of those,
yeah,
too.
Right. I'm sure it'll disappear quickly.
And are you ever doing the old image of the investigative reporter, I mean, like Bob Woodward meeting Mark Felt in the parking garage?
I have a confession to make, Sandy. 35 years in the business, never a single document handed to me in a parking lot except for a parking ticket.
Okay.
David Sanger, national security correspondent for the New York Times. For an extended version of our conversation, you can visit the Speaking Freely section of our website, freespeechproject.georgetown.edu. Our project is funded by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. I'm Sanford Unger. Thanks for joining us on this edition of Speaking Freely.